Good morning. This is Focus 580. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for host David Inge. We have to give him a holiday every once in a while. Glad you could listen today. Whenever politicians talk about improving education, they put testing and accountability high on their list of priorities. We'll give more money to schools, it is said, but demand better results and assess them with standardized or other tests. We certainly saw this during the last presidential election when Al Gore and George Bush both tried to stake out a position of being tougher on school accountability than the other. It seems reasonable to demand that schools demonstrate how well they are performing, and as parents, we certainly want some measure of how our kids are doing as students. But this begs several questions. What is the impact of the testing itself on the outcome of education? Do the assessment methods we use actually work? And might they also have some other impacts that we should know about? Are more tests a good idea, and what kind of tests are most helpful to the goals of education? During this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with one of the most respected researchers on these kinds of questions. Robert Lynn is Distinguished Professor and Co-Director of the National Center for Research on Evaluation, Standards, and Student Testing at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He has won every possible honor from the American Psychological Association, the American Educational Research Association, and the National Council on Measurement in Education. He's also currently chairperson of the Board on Testing and Assessment of the National Academy of Sciences, and is also a member of the Colorado Standards and Assessment Development and Implementation Council. To say he has published widely on the subject would be a grave understatement, but in addition to his scholarly work, he has a great deal of experience dealing with the policy issues that go along with educational accountability. And we should mention that Dr. Lynn is a graduate of the University of Illinois, having earned a master's degree and a PhD here in Champaign-Urbana. He also held a professorship here for about 12 years and served as chairperson of the University of Illinois Department of Educational Psychology. Dr. Lynn will also be giving a public lecture at 4 o'clock this afternoon as part of the Center for Advanced Study Millicom Lecture Series at the Levis Faculty Center, room 407, and that's free and open to the public if you'd like to attend that. You're also welcome to call in with questions during this hour. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, or 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, elsewhere 800-222-WILL. Dr. Lynn, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Just to start, we seem to go through waves of reform in which tests and assessments are the centerpiece. Is that pretty much what you've observed?
That's very true. Back in the the late 1970s and early 1980s, the focus was on minimal competency testing. A lot of places put in requirements for high school graduation. The best known of those is probably Florida. And then that movement kind of died down in part because I think people realized that the minimums that were being sought on those tests were not what they really want for children, so that the emphasis gradually shifted into aspiring higher standards and tests that would be more demanding than the minimal competency tests.
Mm-hmm. Certainly in the recent political rhetoric, we've seen, as I sort of alluded to in the introduction, both the presidential candidates, and I think it's a very popular notion. I know here in Illinois, we're talking about increasing the role of testing and also increasing teacher testing, you know, demanding that teachers meet certain standards and so forth. And I suppose it might be a cynical question to ask, but does the urge to test sort of serve as an easy answer for those seeking to be seen doing something about education?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think there's also a frustration in the sense that it's hard to know or how you influence what happens behind the classroom door. And it's also expensive to make changes that have been shown to have substantial impacts, like big reductions in class size, like having more free time for teachers to have professional development to make sure that they have the content skills that they are trying to teach. They understand that the material and mathematics and science in particular have been issues where it's hard to find people who have those kind of backgrounds and skills, understandings, in part because there are so many more attractive jobs, I think, in terms of financial rewards for people who have those skills. Testing is something that a governor or a state legislature can influence from afar. They can make something happen by having a test mandated. They can also show what happens on test results so that there is a public reporting and, in that sense, an accountability.
Sure. Is there, when a new test is introduced, I wonder if you can sort of describe, you know, obviously the different kinds of tests, and perhaps over time there have been different, you know, sort of different models of testing. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's quite accurate. Well, I mentioned the minimal competency test.
Yeah.
There are different states have put in different kinds of tests. Some of them I would call ambitious tests that require substantial amount of writing on the part of students, for example. They are not limited to multiple choice questions. State of Kentucky has been a leader in that regard, that they have had students put together portfolios of written work, for example, in writing. They have their classroom tests that are called on demand, where you, like people are used to, you sit down and take a test. Are very open-ended in terms of time that they allow students, and they do demand that the students do a lot of writing. Other states have opted for using tests that are off-the-shelf standardized tests, entirely multiple choice, that use basically the same form of the test year after year. And so those are, and in my view, it makes a big difference which of those things you do, because if you use the latter approach, there's a tendency for the test to become essentially the curriculum. And if you have a test that's not ambitious, you have ambitious curriculum goals, they're really out of alignment. And so you end up with a teaching to the test in an undesirable sense. I think no one would argue that you should, if you have tests that are important, that you shouldn't prepare students for them. But there's a difference between preparing students for a test that you think of as sampling a broad array of material that's requiring them to do the things that you really have in mind in the curriculum, like writing, and one that is just a correlate of that, as in the case of a multiple choice question, say you have 30 of them on in a given topic at a given grade level, and everyone would think that that's not really what I mean by mathematics, that you could just learn to answer those 30 questions.
You say that based on past experience, policymakers can reasonably expect increases in scores in the first few years of a program, with or without real improvements in the actual of education.
That's true. In part, it is the focusing in on the test, and that can part of that can be good, and it is real in the sense that children are able to answer those particular questions. And if you have a cynical view of what's happening in classrooms, some people would say, well, at least you know that something's happening and that's desirable. There, a number of years ago, there was a set of articles on what was came to be known as the Lake Wobegon effect, where a medical doctor, observed that essentially all the states were reporting that their students were doing better than the national average. So hence the Lake Wobegon.
Everyone was better than the average.
Right, yeah. Right. And it turned out that what happens is that a state that has had in place, say, the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, that's a standardized test, and then having that for a few years and showing increases, they switch to another test, say the Comprehensive Test of Basic Skills by another test publisher, they would all of a sudden show a big drop in how they were doing compared to the national norm, and then they would start back up. I call this the sawtooth effect, where you have uphill and then change tests and a big drop, and then you start back up the hill, kind of like driving in Colorado sometimes.
So really, what we're talking about is the matching of the curriculum to the test, and where you put so much emphasis on the test, then that drives the curriculum.
That's right, and a big industry, in fact, has grown up, known as test prep, and you can sign onto the web and go to a site called UTest, for example, and you find materials there that will help prepare students for tests that are being required in various states. And that's just one example. There are materials called Scoring High and so on that claim to produce these big gains in performance.
Well, certainly when I took the SAT, I took a preparation course, and it helped me tremendously. I scored very high, and I don't think I would have if I had not.
Well, that's debatable whether or not you would have.
We'll never know.
Yeah, you'll never know. That's exactly right. Well, certainly, I mean, the College Board that puts out the SAT also has test practice books, and going through that, I think it's a very sensible thing to do so that you know what's being expected there. There's a difference between one of the differences between the SAT and the tests that are used in many school districts is that the SAT, you have a different form of it every year. Yeah. And this has to do, or every time you have a new administration. So that when you're preparing for it, there are pieces that are test coaching, that is the tricks of the trade, so to speak. And then there are other parts that where you're really learning the mathematical reasoning skills that are being measured on the SAT, mathematics. And so those are, I think, different aspects as compared to a scoring high program that focuses on a particular form of a test really improves on that, but not necessarily if you had several alternate forms of it, like the SAT, wouldn't show as much.
Do some tests have a built-in cultural, ethnic, or gender bias? This is a criticism that has been leveled, and I wonder what the research shows on this that sort of favors the white male cohort.
Well, there's been a lot of research on that question, and unfortunately, there a good deal of it talks back past the people. There's an impasse between the researchers that are framing the issues in terms of what do you mean by bias? And so, for example, with the SAT, looking at whether or not what you would predict to be the grade average in college of a student, an African-American student compared to a white student, for example, the expectation when they start doing those studies is that the African-American student would actually, on average, do better than the prediction from the test. In fact, the research shows that to some slight extent, it's just the opposite, that the African-American or Hispanic students on average tend to do slightly worse than you would expect from the equation that they develop in prediction. Now, there are a lot of reasons for that, including the fact that on average, African-American students would be coming into college more likely to have to work while they're there. It's a bigger change in the environment, not always, obviously, but on average. And so that might be explaining part of what's there. So,
well, you mentioned something. Class and economic advantage certainly play into how well people do on test scores and in education in general.
Well, there's no question about that. There's lots of research that would show that the students in the suburbs, upper middle class students, are going to perform better on a wide variety of academic tests, achievement, or whether they're called achievement or aptitude tests, than poor inner city students. So And that's what part of what I was saying when I think that the researcher and the critic who's claiming bias on the test are talking past each other, because one group is seeing the obvious difference in performance and saying that that shows that there's a bias. Another way of looking at that is to say that indeed it shows there's a bias or unfairness. But maybe it's a bias or unfairness in the society, as opposed to and what educational opportunities students have, as opposed to the test itself. So it's a
very interesting. We have a call to talk with. We'll include them in our conversation and would welcome others. Our guest is Dr. Robert Lin. He is co-director, of the National Center for Research on Evaluation Standards and Student Testing at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's here to give a Millicom lecture at 4 o'clock today at the Levis Faculty Center. And we're talking about educational testing and assessment accountability issues. Calls are welcome, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. I don't know if this is an appropriate question or not to ask, but I'm going to try. I have a first grade child that, along with the whole first grade in the whole district, was given a test that was designed to assess ability without the student having to read, write, or speak. And I just wondered what type of test is that, and what conclusions can you draw from such a test?
This is an area that I don't study personally all that much, but let me try to comment. There are a lot of tests of that nature that are designed to find out how familiar children are with things like pictures, being able to name pictures of trees or clowns or various things like that, to get a sense of what sort of vocabulary they have, or to have words written to them and have them point to it, whether they say the words themselves or not. And those tests have been found to predict to some extent the later performance of the students when they're in first grade, say, and learning to read. They are not, in my view, ones that I would put great stock in one way or the other. That is, if it was my son he did well on it, I of course would be pleased.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I wouldn't want to take that. I want to take that with a grain of salt and say that doesn't mean that all's going to be fine and I don't have to worry about it when he gets in first grade and starts learning to read. Or the converse, if it was not doing well, then that might raise questions about is the child being exposed enough to looking at books and things, which have been found to be something that predicts later performance when they start learning to read. So if they're read to a lot and looking at pictures and books and practicing those things, they're likely to do better than they would if they're not doing that. So,
you know, every parent, of course, thinks their kid's a genius, right? You know,
and I have two of them. I know,
right,
they're 37 and 34 now.
Yeah, and so of course, my son's been reading like for years. You know,
uh-huh.
He's little. I mean, he's seven now, and he's been reading and doing math and all this kind of stuff. And he had this test, and he did horribly on it. I mean, just a terrible score. And I was like, what? You know,
I don't think you have. I don't think you have anything to worry about.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, but it's like, it just is kind of, you know, it just makes me wonder about
right.
You know, when you talk about tests and inferences that you make about them, mm-hmm. You know, like, this test has to be wrong, you know? I don't know.
Well, if I were you, I would stick with that belief from what you've told me.
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks very much for the call. Well, is there a different set of skills in taking a test than actually, knowing the stuff you're supposed to know?
Well, on some kinds of tests, yeah. There are skills that are helpful.
Yeah.
On the SAT, for example, they have in mathematics, they have an item type that's called quantitative comparisons, where you have, it's a multiple choice, where you have you're supposed to compare two quantities. That's why the name quantitative comparisons, like A squared and A, and your task is to say, is the one on the left larger, smaller, equal, or can't tell? And so there are certain strategies that are desirable for ruling out things on that. In the example of A squared and A, reminding people that, you know, if you had a negative number and you square it, it does a different thing than if you have one that is positive, and that if A was zero, it wouldn't matter if you squared it. Little things like that that are helpful reminders for people that are going through them. Those kind of coaching that's narrow to the format of the test only takes you a little ways, I would think. The research, in fact, shows that kind of coaching has a little impact, but not a very big one. You were talking earlier about you were preparing for the SAT, and if that was all you did, you might have seen 10 points or 15 points on the 200 to 800 scale as the result of that, but not 50 or 100 points.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah. Well, in that case, it was pretty in-depth coaching on the actual substance.
Right. Now that makes a bigger difference, yeah. Especially if it takes place over a long time. One of the researchers that looked at coaching made the point that if you have the longer period of time that you have doing the substance of the material that you're looking at, mathematics in the case we're talking about, the closer it becomes to instruction.
Yes.
So in that sense, you expect instruction to have an effect, or you hope it does, certainly.
You certainly do.
So you shouldn't be surprised that long-term coaching of that kind would have an effect.
Good. We have a couple of the calls to talk with, and we're about at our midpoint with Dr. Robert Lin, co-director of the National Center for Research on Evaluation Standards and Student Testing, University of Colorado at Boulder. And we'll welcome other callers, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in rural Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Dr. Lin, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Just fine. This is Norm Stenzel. I think the woman previously was sort of skirting around the issue of consequential validity. And although you told her not to worry, maybe I would worry. What is going to happen with those scores, and how justifiable are those actions that might be taken? Could you talk a little bit about the new idea of consequential validity, please?
Sure. That's a good question, good clarification. When I was saying not to worry, I meant about whether or not her child was in difficulty because of results on the test compared to the other observations that she had. Certainly it would be the case. I would worry if the school was going to use that to say that this child was not, well, I guess the child was 7 years old, so it wouldn't be the case that they weren't already in first or second grade. But sometimes tests have been used in the early grades to say that the child is not ready to start kindergarten or first grade, unbelievably. I would very much worry about that kind of consequence if the test was being used in that way, and would resist it if I were the parent.
It seems to me that consequential validity is a very difficult thing for users to get a handle on. I don't think. The measurement people talk about it, but I think the end user has to begin talking about it, and I haven't heard the end user being very eloquent about the idea at all. What's your experience with the popular understanding of consequential validity?
Well, like you, I would say that it has not become part of the thinking of either of the end user or the policymakers are putting things in place. Part of what we at the center are trying to do is put together a set of standards for how people might think about accountability systems, as an example, because when a politician puts in place a new testing requirement, I think they have in mind that this is a way to improve education. And I'm not so cynical that I would say that they are not sincere in that regard, but then they don't follow it up with evaluating the degree to which it has that impact, as opposed to some other impacts like encouraging students to drop out because they see that they have this requirement at the end of high school or to get into the eighth grade or things like that. And that same level when you're talking about school-level reports, like in Illinois with the ISAT, I think it's called here, the Illinois State Assessment Test, that gives report cards on schools. And the question is, are the consequences of that helpful to education? Does it really lead to improvements in student learning, or is it just symbolic of showing how schools rank order? Pretty much that you could do without the test.
How soon are your materials going to be available for distribution?
Well, they should be hopefully by the end of the summer. We'll have something that will be available for distribution.
And you're going to get it into the hand of all the state legislators that that are considering testing or promote testing? And President Bush.
Well, we're going to be working with the Education Commission of the states, and they are going to be helping us try to disseminate it to policymakers of the kind that you're talking about. So that's the aim.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. We have a couple people waiting. We'll get next to a listener in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you. My question is, in the neighborhood of accountability, do you have an understanding of how the fact that they're going to have to take a test affects the teaching climate in the classroom? For instance, on the positive side, does it help to make the teacher and the classroom cover the materials that they need to cover, mm-hmm. or does it inhibit creativity by making them follow a particular line and instead of going where people tend to go?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that depends in part on the test itself. If you have, as we were talking about earlier, if you have a test that is not very ambitious and has 40 multiple choice items, and you know that those are what's going to be on the test, I think it has rather negative consequences on what teachers do. They understandably think that they have to focus attention on that, and it's not unheard of for them to spend two or three weeks before the test is coming out doing nothing but test preparation on that. And that, I think, is quite undesirable. On the other hand, if you have a test that is more ambitious, one that, for example, that would require students to write, and what happens is that teachers then have students do more writing, I think that this is a desirable effect. So it varies quite a lot depending on the nature of the test.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Just a follow-up on the question of the last caller. The idea of standardized tests in particular has been talked about a lot in the political rhetoric. And it has great appeal on the surface. I mean, the notion that as citizens of a technological democratic nation, we should all share a basic set of knowledge and skills. But that also flies in the face of evidence that people learn in different ways and at different paces, and we have different aptitudes and ways of learning. Mm-hmm. I mean, is how do you reconcile those two urges or facts? Or can you?
Well, I'm not sure you can entirely. I think that having a standardized test that gives you a reading of that on a common yardstick can be desirable. It's kind of a Pollyanna view, I'm afraid, that says that it's a desirable thing to know about if you don't put too much weight on it. You know, the problem is living up to that proviso that you don't put too much weight on it, because as soon as you start putting too much weight on it, then it starts having undesirable effects, I think.
Okay. We have another call to talk with. Let's go on to them. This is another listener in Urbana on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, I had a couple of comments and then a question. Two or three years ago, I helped score a test that was taken in Ohio, I believe it was. And it was a science test given to elementary school kids, grade school kids, and I thought it was really not very good at all, and very the poorly worded questions and the concepts were bad. So I guess I have a question about how good the questions, how good the tests are in terms of the people putting it together, because I had the feeling that whoever put this together just had a mediocre grasp of the concepts and weren't really qualified to do so. And then I better hold off and let you answer that. Come think of it. I didn't realize it was a question.
It sounded like one of me. Who designs the tests?
Who designs the test? Well, there's a good deal of variability in that regard. There are a few major testing companies that do a vast majority of it. There's a group, Harcourt, that is located in San Antonio, Texas, that does quite a bit. There's CTB McGraw-Hill in California that does a great deal of this. And there are several other companies, ignoring the college admissions testing of ACT and the SAT, for example, at ETS. And then there's states have also done more in recent years in customizing tests. Now, I don't know about the one that you're talking about. It sounds to me like it might be an example of that. I'm not familiar enough with the testing program in Ohio to know. And with the customized tests, that's often done by having teachers within the state help put together the test questions, and then they usually have a contractor, something like CTB McGraw-Hill, that will do editing and also some of the test development. So it's a combination of the two. Now, the quality of those questions, and the quality of the questions, I think, behind your question is that I took it a presumption that I would agree with, that the quality of the questions is a critical consideration. And you can't assure that you have quality questions on the cheap, I would say. You have to have people who are very experienced in this, that have the content knowledge to make sure that they're factually correct and consistent with the best thinking in the field. You have to have people who have done it enough that they know how to ask the questions so that they are understandable to students. So it's a non-trivial business to get the questions right, and I don't know in the example that you're talking about if I looked at them, if I would think it lived up to anywhere close to that. It sounds like it wouldn't.
Yeah, well, it's only a small percentage of elementary school teachers who have science degrees, so it seemed to be reflected in the questions. But anyway, this definitely is a comment. I understand that you can kind of predict how well, or to some degree anyway, how well high school students do academically by their involvement in the school and their kind of their enthusiasm for being part of the school, and as exemplified in their participation in extracurricular activities, for example. And I recently have seen some indication that there's a recognition that that's also true within families as well, but in terms of their feeling integrated in the society. And so when a student goes to high school, say, but and his family is somewhat marginalized by society, and probably because he's a minority, say, their ability to, you know, do well on tests, that is, you might put it this way, that their ability to just accept the information they're given in a kind of wholehearted way that allows them to do well on standardized tests is jeopardized, you know. And I don't see anybody really talking to that. I don't see anybody. So to me, when you go test people en masse and then expect that you've got a fair reading of their capability, I just don't buy it, because I know that if you go in, if your family is, like I said, somewhat marginalized because they're a minority and treated rather hostily in a variety of ways, you know, it's just extremely difficult, no matter how intelligent the kid is, to be very accepting of the curriculum he's given. But you can respond to that. That was my comment. But my real question was, I was curious to know, and I missed a little bit of this, but I was wondering just how what's the story with essay questions in these standardized tests that are, you know, these national tests that are attempted. My feeling is that it'd be extremely difficult to, you know, to get you know, the way they score them, you know, having like a lot of different people look at you know, split up the work and each person takes a group. You know, it just seems difficult for me to believe that any time you try to put an essay question that into a standardized test that you could have anything but an arbitrary result. And I'll let you talk to those two things. One, the idea of families being kind of feeling you know, not integrated in the society and it has an effect on their schoolwork, and the other about the essay test. Thanks.
Good, thank you.
Well, with regard to the feeling of the student not being integrated into the society and how that impacts their work in the class as well as their performance on the test, I think, that's not something that I study directly. I think that you have good points there, that to know how to interpret a test score, you have to assume that this student is doing their best, for example. And if a student is not doing that, if they're saying, I'm not going to play your game, then you're not going to get a reading of how much they really know in the subject matter you're trying to test. Now, as far as the essay tests are concerned, I would not agree that it can't be done. And in fact, I think there's a lot of evidence that it can be done, that you have consistent readings from people. So it's not the case that you just have readers divided up and some readers go read that batch and other readers go read another batch without having any checking on whether or not you would get different results depending on who read your paper. So there are the reputable companies all have ways of checking that and monitoring the scoring to make sure that it's done well. And there are examples of tests that have been around for quite some time. The advanced placement tests, for example, have substantial written products in most of the content areas that are judged by readers that are trained carefully, and then they look at the statistics as to how well they're agreeing with each other, agreeing with the target, and the like, and they put in papers that have been graded before as a way of finding out if readers are giving the grade that experts have decided is the appropriate grade to give it.
Our lines are filling up. We have just about maybe 7 or 8 minutes left, so we're going to go on and continue talking with listeners. We're next to someone on a car phone on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, I have a question about the accountability issue. I have my son will be taking the ISAT next year in third grade, and he has an IEP and an aide in the classroom, and he's practically guaranteed to lower their scores. And I was wondering how that will affect how we're looking at these ideas of school accountability and how the children who are guaranteed not to do well on the test are going to affect the school's accountability when they're doing just fine by my daughter who has no problems. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Well, you raise a very fundamental question that the whole society is struggling with, their whole test and accountability system, because there has been, with the IDEA legislation, a requirement that tests be administered in some form to students as much as possible. So this is known as inclusion, including the student in the testing system. And we frankly don't have very good ways of doing that because part of that involves having accommodations that are consistent with the IEP that the student has, the individualized education program for the student. And the extent to which those accommodations really lead to then valid scores that are comparable to those that students without accommodations have is very much in doubt. Now, for the school as a whole, it is the case that if you have a larger number of students in this category that are not going to score in the higher levels, that's going to affect the overall school performance. There needs to be ways to figure out how to take that into account so that the schools are not competing on an unequal footing to the extent possible.
Hope that gets to the caller's question. We have just about 5 minutes left and another caller waiting on line number four in Champaign County. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Yeah, one unequal footing is exactly what we have nationwide with just the funding of schools. But it was Claude Steele on these airwaves, and he also came to campus. I talked about the previous caller, but one's sort of expectations of and how that affects scores. So people here are familiar with that, and it's an important thing to discuss in all these contexts. But I wanted to know, I sort of see California going over the edge, not geographically, but considering what they've gone through with defunding, et cetera, and now they have apparently what Bush is offering, which is to have schools be completely collapsed, I guess, and principals outed, and that's after a three-year period or something like that. It just seems to be designed to add to the chaos of the school system. I don't know how. I don't know if you would see this in the same terms as mine, but I think at least if you would sketch out what they're intending to do, because I find it pretty shocking, and it's just all in this anthem of testing and accountability.
Mm-hmm.
I'll listen off the air, and thanks a lot.
Thanks for the question.
Right. Well, I think that California is an example, one of several examples where they have put in place a testing program that is of this kind that I was referring to earlier, where you have primary reliance on a standardized test, and they're giving it in every grade, and it is compatible with what President Bush has in mind by having all states require testing in grades 3 through 8 every year of all students. And I worry that if you go that direction, you're going to end up with cheapening the kinds of tests, especially in states that have done more admirable jobs, in my view, of having more ambitious tests, because it'll be just too expensive to do that every year in every subject. And then beyond that is the question of what you do with the results. Does that, and now you're getting into really the political arena as to whether or not that's going to lead to vouchers and things like that. And I guess depending on your political view, you have a rather different stance on that. My own view is that that it should not be not happen in ways that I'm worried that it might, which is kind of like giving up on public education and moving people to a system that will serve the people that are already served well better and not necessarily serve the broader society.
We just have about 2 minutes left, and there's a kind of a point that you make in something you wrote about these, you know, setting standards and having a standardized way of measuring. You say the problem of setting standards remains as much a fundamental unsolved problem today as it was 20 years ago. And yet here we are talking about instituting a nationwide sort of standard.
Right. I don't know what you're quoting from exactly, but yeah. I think I would say the same thing,
yeah.
That we don't really have a way to do that. I mean, and we have states all over the country have set these performance levels, calling them names like proficient. I'm not sure what it's called in Illinois. I think they call them level 1 through 5 or something mm-hmm. like that. But the same idea as to what the target, what's good enough, and we don't have a good way of doing that. And it's too often been said that they come out with results that, while maybe would be great if we ever got to nirvana, are too far out of the reach and so tend to lead to discouragement of teachers. And
well, there's much more we could talk about, but we're out of time. I can just tell folks, if you'd like to hear more on the subject, you can attend the Millicom lecture our guests will be giving. Dr. Robert Lynn will be speaking at 4 o'clock this afternoon as part of the Center for Advanced Study Millicom lecture series at Levis Faculty Center in Urbana, room 407. And you're welcome to attend that. And thanks very much for being here. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.